You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. President Biden visited Milwaukee yesterday as part of a push to engage black voters amid tough polling numbers. Here's Biden speaking to the Wisconsin Black Chamber of Commerce on Wednesday.
Across the country, wages for workers are up. Black wealth is a record, up record 60% since the pandemic. So many of you, look, and by the way, I mean this sincerely from the bottom of my heart, we're just getting started.
Biden touched on economic policies, such as a push to extend pandemic-era child tax credits. Biden described his policy as a hard break from what he called trickle-down economics of past Republican administrations. The president's visit came in an economy that looks pretty good to economists, but not so good to everyday people, with about half of Americans rating the economy as poor in recent polls. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What does the national economy look like to you? What does your household economy look like today? What's the most important thing when you look at economic news to you? And do you have thoughts on the Biden administration's economic policies? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Kevin Smith is an assistant professor of economics at Beloit College. Kevin, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, Rob. I'm happy to be here.
Let's start off a big picture, Kevin. I want to get your assessment of the health of the economy right now. We see the Dow hitting records lately, dipped down a bit from a record. Unemployment numbers in the 3-4% range. Inflation have been high, dipping down now. Your thoughts on the big picture?
So the big picture right now is that the U.S. economy is pretty strong if you just look at the numbers, right? Mm-hmm. So unemployment's at 3.7%. Inflation now, the latest reading is at 3.1%, right? Way down from the peak last June, up around 9.1%. So if you just look at the numbers, the economy is doing pretty well. And the consensus amongst economists is the economy is doing pretty well. Then why is there this like disconnect between the economic numbers and what people feel? And the reason is because I think a lot of people are just still recovering from the pandemic. I think the last 3 years have been very rough on people. And then you go straight from a pandemic into incredibly high rates of inflation, the highest that the country's experienced in 50 years. I think that kind of takes a toll on people. So that's what I would say, the big picture. Economy, the numbers are looking really good, but for the average person, they may not be feeling it yet.
I just earlier today saw a survey commissioned by The Atlantic. They asked people about their thoughts on the state of the economy. For the people who didn't like it, a lot of them said the problem was groceries. And here, I'm going to quote, when we asked what people had in mind when they reported that their personal finances were getting worse, 81% chose groceries. Now, I'm the grocery shopper in our family. I could definitely understand that. This is something you're faced with every day, a vital thing, especially if you're lower income, a big percentage of your income. How much of that do you think factors into our perception of the economy?
I think that factors in a big way because it's noticeable, right? Because you go and you buy groceries every week and you're like, whoa, I wasn't paying this in 2019. And so I think people internalize that. And not only that is that when you go and you talk to people within your network, all everyone's talking about, oh, prices of things have just gone. Eggs have gone up. Meat's gone up. All of these things have gone up. So a lot of times people will internalize that because that is real, right? Since 2019, a lot of those basic food items have gone up around 15 to 20%. Now, in the last 12 months, some of those things have started to come back down. But to the average consumer who goes out and purchases things, they still see it. And so I think that really impacts people's perceptions.
Talking to Kevin Smith, economist at Beloit College, looking at the state of the economy after President Biden visited Milwaukee, focused on economic issues. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Doug is with us in Portage. Doug, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a comment, not a question. And my comment is that as a retired person living on a fixed income and watching the economy and watching what I have to pay for, I think the economy is doing remarkably well. It's better than any place else in the world right now. and the people, do I shop the exact same way I did 3 years ago? No, I now make different choices, but I've always, on the time span of 5 years, have had to make different choices as some things go up and some things go down. What the big comment I wanted to say was, the people I know who complain about the economy, I say, what don't you like? And they say, Trump tells me it's bad. And that's all I can say.
Thanks a lot for the call. Kevin, on that perception of the issue, there's definitely a partisan lens, and I think it could go both ways. If you're a devout Republican and there's a Democrat in the White House, you think they're handling the economy bad, flip the labels and people do the same thing. What do you think?
Yep. No, and there's been a lot of research showing this, especially in, say, the last 20 years, whenever the party that you don't support gets into power, perception of the economy tanks. Because, again, people see these things through a partisan lens. And many times it's because everyone's media environment has become so heavily siloed that good economic news or bad economic news that is against your particular political persuasion just never gets through, right? Or if it gets through, it gets kind of warped to say, oh, good economic news is really not that good, or bad economic news is really not that bad. But in an objective sense, everything the caller just said is correct. America is doing better than a lot of its peer countries. In fact, it's doing better than all of its peer countries, actually, in terms of, when you look at economic growth, when you look at in terms of how they've handled, how the Biden administration handled inflation. I mean, America is doing very well, but there is this disconnect that is political. But I think even people who'd say they're not very political would also say, hey, I don't feel like the economy is good.
Thanks for that call, Doug. Kevin, I wanted to ask about a specific policy item President Biden brought up in Milwaukee yesterday, the child tax credit. Now, we had an expansion of it in the, you know, early days of COVID, the thought, we need some money out there for people. It stuck around for a while. People have pointed toward that as cutting the poverty rate, especially for black children. It expired with the pandemic. What do you see as the potential impact of looking at that and bringing it back in some form?
So the child tax credit is a massive policy. And so a little bit of background here. The child tax credit has existed for many years, but in 2021 with the American Rescue Plan, the Biden administration really expanded it significantly and actually allowed families to get checks every month based on the number of children that they had and the age of their child, as well as what income bracket they fell into. And research show that within just that period of time, it cut child poverty for all children in half and cut child poverty for black and Hispanic children by more than that. The issue was is that it's a very expensive policy. To make it permanent, I believe the figures from the CBO was it would be almost $1 trillion to make that permanent. And so it ended up not getting expanded. I believe that it is a policy that is key, especially with how expensive it is to raise a child in the U.S. And I think that if given the opportunity, I think the Biden administration would find a way to continue it. But I think there may need to be some tinkering with it. Senator Mitt Romney in 2021 tried to do kind of a compromised version with it, which kind of lowered the amount that families got and also lowered the threshold that families could get the money. And so I think there can be some tinkering along the edges to try to make it more affordable. But I think expanding the child tax credit, especially making it permanent, would have an immense impact, especially on black families. And the last point I want to make on this is that a lot of times when we talk about wealth and income in the U.S., I don't think a lot of people realize just the gap. The typical African-American family has only around a third of the wealth of the typical white family. And so a policy like the child tax credit would change millions of people's lives.
Kevin Smith is with us, assistant professor of economics at Beloit College. He's talking to us about President Biden's visit yesterday to Milwaukee and the state of the U.S. economy. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Were you affected by that change in pandemic-era child tax credits? Do you want to see it make a comeback as the president is proposing? How has inflation affected you over the past few years? Is the U.S. economy doing well from where you're sitting? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Kevin Smith, assistant professor of economics at Beloit College, about the state of the economy after President Biden focused on economic issues in a visit to Milwaukee yesterday. Let's go back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Robert is with us now in Viroqua. Hi, Robert.
Hey, Robert. Thank you for taking my call. I appreciate it. I just wanted to comment on one of your last callers who said he was on a fixed income and that it's better than it's ever been. I'd like to know what planet he's living on because we're on a fixed income, and I don't see that at all. And I see the problem with fuel and oil. Everything that gets transported to and from stores has gone up. Gasoline has gone up. Truckers are spending more money on gasoline than ever, and that affects the cost of not just food, but products, any kind of product that you want to buy, hardware, furniture. That cost has gone up, I think, you know, at least 15, 20, 25%, and that's not good.
Robert, gotcha. Thanks a lot for that call. Kevin, Robert feeling a lot of different costs on his fixed income and pointing toward, and I remember talking about this in the early days of high inflation, gas prices. Well, we move a lot of things by things powered by gas, yeah. And that had an effect on the rest of the economy.
No, and I understand Robert's point of view, because I think especially when you're on a fixed income, it price changes, you feel them, right? You feel them. And so you have to figure out ways to like live through it. In terms of the point about gas, that is a major input, and prices do tend to follow the changes in global oil markets. What I will say though, in the last few weeks, what we have seen is that gas prices have fallen significantly, right? So it used to cost me around $45 to fill up my tank. Now it costs me about $30, right? And so we do see these prices coming down over time. But I think for a lot of people, again, it's that sticker shock, right? It's that sense that a few years ago, these things did not feel like they cost this much, and why am I paying this? And so even though we're starting to see prices, so like the most prominent one would be gas prices, come down. For a lot of people, it's still the sense that like, oh, but then why is it still so expensive to buy even like the basic necessities?
Thanks again for that call, Robert. Rick is with us now in Monona. Rick, hi.
Hi. I know that a lot of people want to lay the problems today, the economic problems, at Biden's feet, but isn't the reality that this came out of COVID and COVID created like the perfect storm in the economy? There's when we came out of it, there was excessive demand. There were people that had done nothing for 3 years that except store up money in their bank accounts. And the gas prices shot through the roof, and the Federal Reserve really hadn't done its job to monitor that very well.
Rick, thanks a lot for the call. Kevin, either with the current post-COVID situation or in general, how much control does a president have? How much credit do they get for good stuff? How much blame should they get for the bad stuff?
I think it's hard because there'll always be a feeling that the buck stops with the president. But in a fair assessment, the president does not have perfect control over the economy. Their actions and the policies that they support can push the economy in a specific direction. In terms of blaming President Biden, I think that there is a kind of broad debate within economics about Biden's public policy, particularly when he first entered office. So you know, the caller was exactly right. During COVID, people basically sat a huge number of people weren't able to spend a lot of the money that they had accumulated, so they started to dissave and started to go on trips, started to buy things, and demand skyrocketed. And so that led to a lot of shortages, and add with the supply chain issues that were occurring at that time as well, caused massive increases in prices. This is why the inflation that we've all experienced in the last few years was not just siloed in America, it was a global phenomenon. So in that part, that is out of the president's hands. But where economists kind of disagree in terms of Biden's impact is when it comes to things like the American Rescue Plan, spending $2 trillion when he first entered office. Many economists say that was too much, especially since there was really no offsets with the American Rescue Plan. When you spend $2 trillion on top of people having $3 trillion, $4 trillion in savings, that is a recipe for increased inflation. So that's the general argument. My point of view is that I think it's kind of unknowable, because I think the administration came into a pretty bad situation and looked to try to do the best that they could. But I know this will be something that will be debated for the next 20, 30 years.
Thanks a lot for that call, Rick. We're talking about the state of the economy after President Biden's visit to Milwaukee. Kevin Smith stays with us, economist at Beloit College. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Nancy is with us now in Appleton. Hi, Nancy.
Hi. I think, you know, we all have to understand the economy has always been difficult for some people. And it's something that I don't think any president alone is to blame for. I think there's some things that truly are systemic in our society and in our economic system, and they need to be looked at. But I think people also need to look at experts, or at least like your guest today, who has studied this. There's a lot of complicated things, I would think, that go into the economy. And currently, right now, yes, groceries are expensive, but gas has come down. And several years ago, we went on a trip, and I kept commenting, it's the most expensive time, because it was over $4 a gallon back then for gas at that time. Mm-hmm. I think what's hurting a lot of people are what they notice is interest rates now for people who are first-time home buyers. But they've really been used to, I think, a low rate when we bought our first house. But granted, it was not as expensive, but it was a 12% interest rate back in 1980. And we're on a fixed income, too, and somehow, you know, we were savers, so we managed fine right now.
I'm going to cut in because we don't have a ton of time, and you give us a lot to talk about. Okay. First of all, something that, Kevin, you actually say on your Beloit College website, you love working with your students to help them understand how economic trends affect their lives. For someone like Nancy, who's saying, hey, let's look at good information, what do you tell people to look at, you know, lay people who aren't trained economists, to understand the economy?
What I tell them is always look at any kind of data within context, right? And so this is what I teach my students, and this is what I will say to anybody. And I love Nancy's questions, because a lot of what she was saying gets to the root cause of it, right? If you're a young person trying to buy a home, you probably don't think the economy is great because of high interest rates on mortgages. Even though mortgage rates have just started to come down, you're looking at the market and you're like, oh, this is awful, right? And so what happens is that you have to put it within context, where you're like, well, yes, mortgage rates are high now, but where they were a few years ago, it was an unsustainably low level, right? And even compared to historic trends, mortgage rates now are not as high as they were even in the 80s, for example. And so I always tell my students, always try to look at any kind of economic news that you hear within context, because to be honest, it is very easy to take any kind of data point and frame it in a way to fit a certain agenda. And so you always have to be careful of what, even if you trust the source, always think about what is the context of this number that I'm hearing. What is so for example, inflation is 3.1% now. What does that mean compared to where it was, say, 2 years ago? And so that's one of the things that I always tell my students, and I'll tell anyone, always just be mindful of the kind of information that you're hearing and what context does it exist in.
Nancy, thanks a lot for that call. Kevin, in our last minute, there were predictions or assessments that we had a really good chance of going into a recession in 2023, depending on which economist you asked, but it seemed like that risk was there. Not so far. That can change, of course. But briefly, why do you think that hasn't happened, at least not yet?
I think what happened is that many economists assume that as the Federal Reserve started to raise the interest rates, people's spending and just the overall economy would just enter a downward spiral. What ended up happening is that the Federal Reserve raised interest rates and people kept on spending. And part of that is because of pandemic era savings. Part of that was also the fact that the Biden administration passed some pretty big bills. Bipartisan Infrastructure Bill, Inflation Reduction Act, Chips and Science Act. So those federal government also played a role in trying to stabilize the economy. And then the Federal Reserve in general was pretty clear about its strategy of raising interest rates. It didn't jump interest rates too quickly. It did it in a gradual way, allowing the economy to adjust. So I think it's really the fact that consumer spending has really held together that has really stopped the economy from going into a recession.
Kevin, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
That's Kevin Smith, assistant professor of economics at Beloit College. He talked to us about the current state of the economy after President Biden's visit yesterday to Milwaukee. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, Colorado's Supreme Court says Donald Trump can't be on the ballot in that state for violating a 14th Amendment insurgency clause. Other states may follow, and the U.S. Supreme Court is probably going to weigh in. We'll dig into the legal arguments there, and you can join in with your thoughts. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Back in June, the U.S. Department of Agriculture approved the first lab-grown or cultured chicken meat for commercial sale. It's the first cultured meat to be approved in the U.S. It's grown from animal stem cells. No actual animals died in the making of the meat. Don't look for it in the grocery store just yet. So far, it's only available in selected restaurants. And this is different from the veggie meat alternatives you might have seen, maybe eaten, that are based on different kinds of plant or mushroom proteins. A Wisconsin meat science expert joins us now for a look at the science behind the new products and some of the challenges in bringing it to wider markets. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Coming up in just a bit, we want to hear, would you eat lab-grown meat if it became available to you? If you are a vegetarian for whatever reason, is this something you think would count as vegetarian? Are you looking forward to this or not? If you eat meat currently, would you want this in the mix? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Jeff Sindelar is professor and extension meat specialist in the Department of Animal and Dairy Sciences at UW-Madison. Jeff, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. It's great to be back.
Before this news from the USDA permitting this stuff, you had looked into this some and wrote an information thing about this cultured meat, and you wrote that this is new to us, but the technology, the basic technology behind it has been around for a long time. Can you talk about that a little?
Absolutely. I would love to. So the technology behind cell meat or cell-based meats has been around for around 20 years. It started out very slowly and has grown into the industry that it is today. However, the process for working with cells in this fashion has been happening for well over 100 years and has been utilized for lots of different purposes. One of those has been to help develop vaccines and means for treating diseases such as polio.
Now let's talk about the process here. First of all, what kind of animal cells can be the starting point for this cultured meat?
Sure. So really any type of animal cell, or excuse me, any type of animal that possesses cells that are ideal for being good candidates to generate and create these cell-based products or these cell cultivated products. And when I say that, I mean that right, we need cells or in order to be successful in this technology, sales need to be identified that are able to provide the products that are necessary to create a desirable and successful a cell cultivated product, right? So kind of to use an analogy, right? If we want to feed a baby versus feed an adult, we have to think about different types of food, right? And really foods that we're feeding a baby, we're trying to nurture that baby so that they grow and proliferate and are very healthy and strong, as opposed to foods that we feed to normal healthy adults. The same concept is really important to be applied to the cells that are chosen, selected, and nurtured for proliferation and growth into these cell-based products.
So skipping ahead a bit, Jeff, I've taken this cell from a chicken. I have a bunch of undifferentiated chicken cells now. How do we turn that into something that you and I might recognize on our plate? What does it take to take these cells and make something that looks like, I don't know, a chicken breast, or when that comes along, a pork chop or something like that?
Yeah, no, great question. So this is what has been the topic of interest in heavy research for the past, in development for the past 20 plus years. So it takes a group of people with different expertise in cell biology, biochemistry, chemical engineering, analytical chemistry, as well as meat and food science, who with their different backgrounds and knowledge and skill sets can come together and tackle these challenges. But it really starts with those cells, right? Oftentimes they're things like stem cells or these cells, right, that are selected that have specific properties that they can grow and grow quickly and have the ability to adapt to the environment of the development as well as the cultivation. Those cells then are combined with some type of media, and the media is rich in a variety of things such as essential amino acids and different macro and micronutrients, as well as growth factors. Those cells are combined with that media, cultured media, in a bioreactor, so a very controlled environment where it's sterile, warm, right, and very conducive for growth. And then over a matter of a few days to a few weeks, enough of those of the cell growth occurs, which is called biomass, to be able to start having enough cell stuff, for lack of a better word, that can then be either transformed into some type of ground product or go through some additional steps where it is put into like a lattice or a structure that can then be grown and developed into something that might look like a chicken steak or a pork steak or beef steak or something like that.
One of the hopes for this in the long run, if and when this becomes something that can be done at scale, is that it could be overall environmentally a plus compared to the way we get meat now, you know, raising animals in the environment. The thing you just described sounds like a lot of work, fairly energy intensive. What would it take to get from where we are now in this early stage to something where this is a net environmental gain? And I know there's a lot of different ways to measure that.
Yeah, that's a great question, and I don't think that the answer to that question is clear at all as of today, because there's a lot of things that have to be understood, right? The cell-cultivated industry, that technology is still pretty young, and it's really developing, and it's developing very, very quickly, right? and it's to a point where we'll start to better understand, I think, that question in the next 5, 10, maybe 15 years. But right now, it's really unclear whether cell-cultivated products are more environmentally friendly or less environmentally friendly than the traditional animal agriculture routes.
Talking to Jeff Sindelar. He is a professor and extension meat specialist in the Department of Animal Sciences, Animal and Dairy Sciences, I should say, at UW-Madison. Talk about the idea of cultured meat, meat products that start with the cell. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Jeff, I'm trying to figure out who regulates this and how it could be regulated, and I'm guessing people in the industry and people in the government are trying to answer some of those questions. What do we know at this point?
For sure. Regulation is one of the many questions and one of the many hurdles for this technology. All are achievable, right? As of now, there are two companies in the U.S. that are approved to manufacture these products, to produce these products. The regulation for these products are handled jointly by FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, as well as the USDA, United States Department of Agriculture. And essentially, the FDA, since they oversee biotechnology, bioengineering, ingredients, and so forth, they regulate up to a point until cell proliferation or growth of those cells occurs. At that point, USDA takes over regulation, and then they do everything thereafter, which also includes food safety and labeling.
Now, Jeff, as I mentioned at the outset, it's just this cultured chicken product so far. Do you anticipate seeing other birds coming down the pipeline, mammals, cows, pigs, goats, and so on, fish? What are you watching for next when it comes to the product lines that we might see?
Yeah, another great question. So for sure, right, chicken is on the market now. I fully expect other species, right? Everything that we see in the grocery store, right, beef, pork, lamb, poultry, anything that's protein-based, I think will eventually be able to be produced following these cell cultivated technologies. Yeah, it's just a matter of time for sure.
Jeff, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thank you for the questions.
That's Jeff Sindelar, professor and extension meat specialist in the Department of Animal and Dairy Sciences at UW-Madison. We talked to him about some of the science and the process behind lab-grown meats, also called cultured meats, what it would take to bring it to wider markets. Now we want to hear from you. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Would you eat this if it were available in your neck of the woods? Is this something you want? Vegetarians, vegans, would this fit your diet? Yes, no, or you're trying to figure that out. If you currently eat meat, are you interested in these alternatives? Do you like plant-based protein products that, you know, fill in that spot where we might put meat otherwise? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up the conversation about lab-grown meat or cultured meat. There is a chicken product on the market now in select restaurants. Won't be coming to Wisconsin probably for a while, but we're opening things up for you now. Let us know your thoughts on the idea at 800-642-1234. Are you concerned about the ethics of, you know, the way we grow meat now, the way we get it now, its impact on the environment? Does that inform whether or not you eat meat? Do you want this kind of product, cultured meat? If you're vegetarian or vegan, would you eat it? If you eat meat now, do you need it? And if you have religious restrictions on what meat you can eat or when, how do you think this fits in? I think people are trying to figure that out right now. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's go to your calls now. Greg is with us in Davis, Illinois. Greg, hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Greg?
Well, the trigger was I'm a vegan, and most vegans are offended when they're conflated with vegetarians. Vegetarians obviously will eat some animal products such as eggs or cheese, and most vegans are pretty much almost 100% of vegans are going to tell you that the cruelty involved in any kind of animal agriculture is just not worth even, you know, touching. So I just want to make that distinction. I personally don't have a problem with lab-grown meat. I wouldn't eat it myself because I'm sworn off of anything that would look or taste like meat. But I don't have a problem with any vegan wanting to eat that if they are curious or what have you.
And, Greg, I'm going to ask you a question that probably you're sick of and you've heard a zillion times, but I know people, when interacting with vegans, wonder what you do instead of meat. What do you, don't you miss it? What do you do in place of it? What do you tell people?
Well, I think there are numerous meat substitutes on the market that are outstanding. For example, Burger King has the Impossible Burger. That's a meat substitute. It's designed to taste like beef to help wean people off of eating meat. So that's one example. I think its competitor, Beyond Meat, is just as good, if not better. Although the one product that I like to point out, particularly like people in Wisconsin might like, the Impossible Bratwurst is one of the best meat substitutes I've ever tasted. So there's plenty of products on the market that are good.
Greg, thanks a lot for calling in at 800-642-1234. We are opening the lines up for you to share your thoughts on the idea of cultured meat products. Does it, this is like taking a cell from a chicken, that's what's on the market now, growing it, turning it into some sort of chicken-like product, cooking it up. Does that gross you out, or are you excited about that idea? Hope it comes to you soon. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Tracy joins us now in Manitowoc. Tracy, hi.
Hi. I had a question as to whether or not there have been any studies done on the effect of this cultured meat on humans.
It's pretty new. The FDA has approved it, Tracy. I don't want to speak to all the science behind it. The notion, at least so far, the FDA seems to be okay with it. What do you think? Is this something you would serve up or no?
That would be a solid no for me. I mean, we don't even know if that would be something that would be healthy for us.
Gotcha. Do you look for meat substitute products at all in your life, Tracy? Or are you just fine with eating meat as is or a little of both?
I'm actually going the opposite direction. I'm looking for more farm-grown meat less processed, the better.
And is there any particular product you found here in Wisconsin where you're like, yes, I've got a great local source for it?
I do have some sources in Manitowoc that they grow their own pigs and their own cattle, and the meat is absolutely delicious. It costs a little bit more, but it's a great way to get your protein.
Okay. Tracy, thanks a lot for sharing that with us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We heard from Dave on the Ideas Network Facebook page who says, there's plenty of venison running around my yard, eating everything in sight. Lots of fresh meat to be had. I'm guessing venison will probably be a little lower on the list, but who knows? That could come along someday. You could join that conversation on the Ideas Network Facebook page or email ideas@wpr.org or call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on the idea of cultured meat. Caller on the line, but I'm not able to take them just yet, it looks like. Nope. Okay, it's still time for you to share your thoughts, though. 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We've got Kathy. There we are in Milwaukee. Kathy, hi.
Hi. I might eat it. It's an interesting option because lab-grown meat is going to be a lot cleaner, free of antibiotics, and that's a big reason why I don't virtually never buy chicken right now. And I'm wondering about the cost. Is this going to be more expensive than or on the same price line of higher grade meats?
Interesting, Kathy. Thanks a lot for sharing that. Well, we took a few calls there, but you can keep the conversation going over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let us know your thoughts on the idea of lab grown meat. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a tour of a special cave.
Bats are an important part of Wisconsin's wildlife. But over the last decade, a fungal disease called white nose syndrome has devastated bat populations in the state and across the country. In rural Crawford County, a cave that once was a tourist attraction is now protected by the Mississippi Valley Conservancy. It's a safe haven for the bats to hibernate and help scientists develop ways to stop the disease. Most of these bats have settled in for the winter, but before they returned, WPR's Hope Kerwin traveled underground to learn more about this unique cave.
So the entrance to the cave is inside this little building. Welcome to Kickapoo Cavern. I'm Sarah Bratnober. I'm Communications Director at Mississippi Valley Conservancy. This doorway is really the only way in for people, but if you look up there, you see a little slot along the edge of the ceiling there. That's where the bats come in. Some bats fly south in the winter to relax and be snowbirds, but there are four species of bat. They tend to hibernate here in the Northland, and so they look for places to hibernate where they're not going to freeze to death over the winter. There are a few low spots, so we're going to just take a little duck down here. We are in a completely different space now. We're underground. Oh, this must be 15 feet tall, the ceilings here. All around us, we're seeing kind of a flowing forms of limestone that are being dissolved. It's very damp in here because water is a part of what's going on that created this cave and continues to shape it. Do you see those cages under the stairway? We're making research accessible for the DNR and their partners to actually study possible solutions to the white nose syndrome. It's a fungus that's in this cave, and it makes their skin itch. It makes them wake up. And in the middle of winter, then they start flying around looking for something to eat, and they just don't have the calories stored for them to be able to fly around. There is nothing to eat down here in the winter, and most of them have starved as a result of being awoken. One of the things we do is just help people to be aware of bats and what bats need and why bats are good and what people can do for bats. But, you know, a lot remains to be seen about how the bats will do with this fungus in the environment. Will they develop a resistance to it? Is that why some of the bat populations in Wisconsin are coming back in the last year? We don't know yet. Okay, here we go. We're just about at the end of the cave now. And if we go down to the very end here and look over the edge, you will see that is a pool of water right there. A lot of people have never seen anything like this before. And kids who get the chance to come down here are really wowed by it. You know, what a great way to introduce them to some of these ideas about conservation.
WPR's Hope Kerwin took us on a tour of the Kickapoo Caverns. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. And find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on Wisconsin Public Radio.